Welcome to another episode of Spanish History 101. This is episode 20, The 12th Century and the Plot Thickens. And it really does. The whole land is enmeshed in myriad conflicts, and it would seem that we are in the midst of perpetual change and interruption. The concept of status quo is basically non-existent. Just what is the situation at the beginning of this period? Well, Al-Andalus, or Muslim Spain, is basically a confederacy of territories known as taifas, and they are loosely united by their religion, and also they are under the influence of the most recent group of Muslims to dominate their part of the country, the Almoravids, a tribe of Berbers from the deserts of North Africa who came to the peninsula around 1086 to bring a little order to things as they were getting out of control. You see, up to that point, much of the Muslim ruling class was getting lax about observing Islamic law, and they were also struggling to put up any stiff resistance to the encroaching Christian forces, who in turn were advancing ever so slowly as they bickered amongst themselves constantly. So the Almoravids, who were originally based in the newly founded city of Marrakesh, rode in and, just as the previous dynasty, the Umayyads, had done, made their presence known immediately. Success came early and often, in particular the Battle of Sagrajas. And just as their predecessors had done, once here they liked what they saw and decided to stay on. They would take control of most of the taifas for the next 60 years or so, but we'll get back to them in a second. On the other side of the land, the Christian kingdoms continued to vie for power, while at the same time, on occasion, challenged the Moors. León is still hanging in there, the Kingdom of León I'm talking about, but it's slowly getting pushed out by the emerging Castile. Alphonse VI was the most powerful ruler. During the final few decades of the 11th century, he was the one who liberated Toledo in 1085 in a symbolically and strategically important milestone. Toledo was once the capital of Visigoth Spain hundreds of years before that, until 711, more or less, it might have been 712, when it was taken over by the Moors. It took all of 374 years for the Christian forces to get it back. So it took a while, but they eventually got the job done. Alfonso VI died in 1109, and without a male heir, because his son Sancho had been killed the year before at the Battle of Ucles, that left his position open, and it was going to be filled by his daughter, Urraca. Now, the name Urraca is a tough-sounding name for a tough-sounding woman. It's also a Spanish word, a word for a specific bird called the magpie, which isn't the most flattering name in the world. So on top of that, she went by Doña Urraca, or Lady Magpie. And it seems to be a fitting name because she was no pushover. Now, Urraca had married the King of Aragon, Alfonso I, El Batallador, which translates something like the warrior, the battler, the fighter. And Alfonso was a career soldier. In addition to being king, he was the King of Aragon from 1104 to 1134, and he expanded the kingdom to almost twice its original size, taking the city of Zaragoza during his reign. I think that was around 1119, 1117, 1119. This, along with Toledo, was another major blow to Muslim Spain. Urraca's and Alfonso's marriage clearly had geopolitics in mind, but it can only be described as ill-fated due to their strong characters, which was exacerbated by personal ambition. Alfonso had his sights set on Castile and León, figuring Urraca was not suited for the job, but Urraca was not about to relent. The different factions of nobility supporting each side only made things worse. And for a few years there, it was just mayhem. You couldn't trust anything or anyone. In fact, these spouses couldn't even trust each other. It wouldn't be long before Urraca said she'd had enough and asked the Pope, no less, to annul the marriage on the grounds that they were cousins, as if that ever really mattered in the history of royalty. But anyway, that was the excuse she gave. That ticked off Alfonso so badly that he had his wife put under house arrest in a castle. So I guess that would make it castle arrest, actually. And she stayed there until she was rescued by a loyal subject. Now, eventually their marriage was declared null and void. Urraca's son from a previous marriage, his name was also Alfonso, would take over for her, and he would become King Alfonso VII of Castile and León. Alfonso ruled from 1126 to 1157. During his reign, he was declared emperor of all of Hispania, or Spain, in the Cathedral of León. Now, this wasn't quite true by any stretch of the imagination, mainly because he was not in control of all of Spain, but it was yet another nudge, or an example of another nudge towards that sort of modern notion of Spain. And if we move over to Aragon, to the east, another problem has arisen with the death of Alfonso I. He, too, left this world childless. This was especially surprising because he certainly had his chances to procreate, but many believe that he was either sterile or gay, as he preferred to be among his men in military campaigns rather in the arms of his wife. But I think the sterile theory seems to be the prevailing belief among experts today. Anyway, in his will, he requested his possessions be given to a number of monastic orders. I think it was the Templars, the Order of Malta, and the Order of Sepulchre. Now, as generous as that may have sounded, the nobility in Aragon would have nothing of it. They wanted an heir and needed one quick, but none was to be found, so they resorted to Plan B, which required a little bit more patience and ingenuity. Alfonso had a brother. His name was Ramiro. He would become Ramiro II, dubbed the Monk, and that was because he really and truly was a member of the clergy. He had spent most of his life in a monastery, and in fact, he was bishop at the time when he learned of his brother's death. Ramiro was chosen to succeed Alfonso, but it would seem that the real reason he was there was so he could ensure the continuation of the dynasty. So Ramiro was basically removed from his monastic life to become ruler of a kingdom and basically have sex until he sired an heir. I guess on paper, as a job offer, it doesn't sound too bad. He married a woman named Inés of Aquitaine, and they had a daughter named Petronilla. So they got their heir. Petronilla would eventually marry the Count of Barcelona, Raymond of Berenguer, and their union would create the crown of Aragon in 1162. This was sort of a unification of the Kingdom of Aragon and Catalonia, and this allowed the previously landlocked Aragon to have access to the sea, the Mediterranean, via Catalonia. And what a difference it would make. Aragon's growth as a power would increase dramatically. Catalonia would become the economic motor of the kingdom, a kingdom which will eventually control the Balearic Islands and much of southern Italy and Sicily. So things were improving for them in that department. Now, let's get back to the Moors. The Almoravids had initial success from Yusuf ibn Tashfin, who thrashed the Christians' forces again and again until his death in 1106. He was followed by Tamim al-Yusuf, who consolidated the Muslim power and Muslim unity more than anything else. He was the one who led them to victory at Ucles in 1108, as we mentioned before. And then his son, Ali ibn Yusuf, took over in 1119 and ruled until 1143. It was around this time, about 1120, that the Almoravids had reached their height of power, but their decline came almost as fast as their rise, like their predecessors, they became a little bit too comfortable with life in Spain. They started to lose their control, a lot of infighting. On top of that, losses to the Castilians, Aragonese, French, and Portuguese during the 1140s reinforced that notion ever so quickly. On top of that, a new clan, a new dynasty from North Africa, this I believe was from the Atlas Mountains, was putting pressure on them. They were called the Almohads, a similar sounding name just to make things a little more confusing. We have the Almoravids, and now these are the Almohads, and they were the new Berbers on the block, and they weren't messing around. They were also strict observers of Islamic law, in fact, stricter than the Almoravids, that's what they say, and not very tolerant of slackers, much less infidels like the Christians and the Jews. And this would be very bad news for the inhabitants of Al-Andalus. So, we are starting to notice a pattern here, it would seem. The invaders arrive, romp, preach strict moral living, settle down, and begin to live, and more importantly, enjoy the good life of Spain. And before you know it, they no longer practice what they preach. That is, until the next wave of Islamic fanatics comes in, and we start all over. Now, it's a bit simplistic, and it's a bit tongue-in-cheek, but there's something to it. And if you ask me, I think the same thing happens to a lot of foreigners to this day when they come to Spain. Anyway, the Almohads began their incursion into the Iberian Peninsula in 1146, and so Spain was hit by yet another wave of Muslim invaders. Each time they seemed to be just a little bit more extremist, religiously speaking, that is. The Almohads would move the capital from the legendary city of Cordoba to Sevilla, and though you may think initially that isn't really that important, consider that the famous and magnificent Giralda Tower, which forms a part of the Cathedral of Seville, as well as the Alcázar, are legacies from that time. So we have the Almohads to thank for those jewels of Spanish heritage. It's also further proof, as if anywhere really needed, that these were no mere savages, as history books centuries later tried to portray them as. These were not necessarily civilized times for anyone. Not for the Muslims, not for the Christians, I might add. But each side had its share of cultural glory and savagery at the same time. Once again, they began to bring some unity to the Taifas, and it's believed that culturally, Al-Andalus sort of returned to a certain level of glory. Anyway, the Christians were not satisfied with this situation, but it took them a while to react. They finally did in 1195, at the end of this century, or the 12th century. Alfonso VIII of Castile tried to take them on with the help of several military orders, and the Almohads, under Yusuf Yuqub al-Mansur, who also counted on the aid of a disgruntled and resentful Christian named Pedro Fernandez de Castro, believe it or not, met them on the battlefield. The place, Alarcos, in the province of what is today Ciudad Real, and the result, a total disaster for the Christian forces. Al-Mansur easily defeated the opposition. It was a humiliating defeat, and once again it seemed as if the progress from recent years was all going to pot. And so we close the 12th century with things looking pretty unstable, just the way we began the century, but we'll leave it there, and we'll leave a little bit of intrigue for the next episode. Just a quick summary to help you make some sense of this crazy and confusing, this baffling history. The 12th century was another century of constant change and instability. The frontiers are pushed back and forth. Iberia or Hispania or pre-modern Spain, what have you, gets invaded for a third time, this time by the Almohads in 1146. It was a very busy century for the different Christian kingdoms. The center of power is shifting. Castile continues to grow, and assumed the role as leader of the Reconquista. León is still important, but fading somewhat. Galicia remains an important spiritual center, thanks to Santiago de Compostela, but is losing a bit of its independence. It's usually either a part of León or Castile. Then Portugal. We haven't talked much about Portugal, I guess because it ends up being a separate country, but at this time, it's just another one of the kingdoms that we've been talking about. Portugal has finally been founded as a kingdom in 1139. It used to be a county. Now it's a kingdom under Afonso I, after wresting its way free of León. Aragon not only grows as a kingdom, it eventually unites with the Catalan counties and creates the crown of Aragon. And Navarra, which we haven't talked too much about, but it's always there. It's always been there. It used to be the Kingdom of Pamplona, but now we're going to call it the Kingdom of Navarra. It spent much of the century trying to stave off Castile and Aragon from absorbing it. So that, hopefully, should help you understand the situation. And don't feel bad if you find this all rather confusing, when not overwhelming. That's because it is. Take the names, for example, just the names themselves. You have, for example, Afonso, without the L, Afonso I, King of Portugal. Then you have Alfonso VI, Alfonso VII, and Alfonso VIII, Kings of Castile and León. And then you have Alfonso I, King of Aragon. All different people, rulers of different lands, but living more or less at the same time. And the same can go for names like Sancho and so on. By the way, speaking of names, we have a little name trivia for you. The last name Sanchez, for example, which is a very common last name for Spanish speakers, is just a Spanish way of saying son of Sancho. So that E-Z at the end is an old way of saying son of. Just like Johnson in English, or MacDonald, of son of Donald in Scotland, O'Malley in Ireland. You have other names like Fernandez, son of Fernando, Velázquez, son of Velasco, López, son of Lope, and so on. Anyway, I just thought you might find that interesting. Anyway, I hope you have enjoyed this podcast by Brian Spaindemain. Please feel free to leave us any comments, because we love the feedback. You can subscribe to our podcast on Spotify, Amazon, Apple, and Castos. If you wish to support Brian Spaindemain, please click on our PayPal donate button. Or if you want to have access to absolutely all of our podcasts, you can check us out on Patreon at the link provided below. Stay well, stay safe, and hasta pronto. Thank you.